Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. All right, welcome everybody. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us on Zoom for the first time. Welcome back to everybody else. I like to, I forgot my mic. Can you hear me okay at home? Yeah, good enough. I'd like to begin by asking you to talk to each other for a minute, meet some people. It's one of the core principles of Buddhism to develop Sangha, which is the term for community. And it's one of the three refuges, one of the three core principles of Buddhism is the first one is that we can awaken through our own efforts. We can become a liberated being, taking refuge in Buddha, Buddha nature, Buddha potential within each one of us. Taking refuge in the Dharma, the ability to understand what is true and what is not true, to see it directly, to know it directly, not the kind of my truth versus your truth, my opinion versus your opinion, but that which is actually true in the world, in the universe, in nature, the Dharma. And the Sangha, which is community, and all of Buddhism is relational. A lot of it is how we relate to ourselves, to our own minds, to our experience, our experience in the world. And then there's this, we're in this series of mindfulness teachings, and we're like 7 weeks in and have like three or four more weeks as we're slowly going through what's called the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. And after every mindfulness instruction, the Buddha says this is to be practiced both internally and externally, both mindfulness of our own internal experience and also externally, and how we talk to each other and how we listen to each other and how we relate to the world and our experience in the world. So I like to start by helping you develop community by talking to each other. The topic for tonight's aspect of the mindfulness teaching is the five aggregates or five skandhas, the five aggregates, probably the best translation. It's the five aspects of our experience that we tend to be identified with as self. And so the aggregates, sometimes this term skanda or aggregate is also like a heap, the different heaps of our, or piles, the different piles of experience that we tend to consider that's who I am. And the first one is our bodies, the aggregate of a physical form. We have a body. The second one is our mind. We have a mind that thinks and plans and remembers. And the third one is the perception of feeling tone, of feeling pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The fourth is the part of our mind that that remembers, that so often we create ourselves based on past experiences. Like there's that interesting, like if you forgot everything, if you weren't basing your identity, your on the past, who would you be right now if there was no past? And the fifth one is consciousness itself, that which is aware. So we're going to meditate. We're going to investigate that. I'm going to talk a bit about it tonight. But when you think about this in your own life and for discussion with each other, what are you most identified with? Are you more identified with like you're your body? This is me. I am this physical form. That's who I am. I'm this gender, I'm this race, I'm this whatever it is, you know, orientation, whatever it is that you identify with. I'm, you know, this old. I am in my 50s. I am in my 30s or 40s or I am this body. I'm this body's experience. That's my identity. We all probably have a bit of that, pretty natural to have some identification with the physical form as self, as personal. Or maybe do you lean a little bit more towards like, I'm my personality, not so identified with my body, but I'm my mind. I'm that inner voice. I'm that personality. I view myself as I'm an introvert, or I'm an extrovert, or I'm a clown, or I'm insecure, or, you know, or I'm an addict. You know, so many of us in recovery from addiction of like, that's who I am. I'm an addict. I'm identified with the history of addiction that I've experienced. I don't know, do you, or maybe some of you identify as consciousness, really spiritual people, that bumper sticker that says, I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. Bumper sticker Dharma. I am consciousness. What is it like temporarily experiencing this human form? From a Buddhist perspective, all it's like D, none of the above. None, you know, all of those things that we cling to, that we identify that with, are all a bit mistaken. And we'll explore that tonight. But just I think for interest of the humility of being like, yeah, I walk around thinking I'm my body all day, or my personality, or believing my mind. My mind tells me all kinds of shit. And I mean, how much of the percentage of the time do you believe your thoughts? It's interesting to, you know, if we could really be like, well, 90% of the time I believe what my mind tells me, my views, my opinions, my emotions. I think like, that's me. That's true. I am angry. I should be angry. Or I am afraid. I should be afraid. That's, and we believe it. And then it'd be interesting if we could actually have some sort of truth-telling equation. How much of the time is it true? Our opinions, like, especially like, your mind have a tendency to worry about stuff or to, you know, fantasize or all of that future tripping that the human mind does all by itself. And then we kind of look back and be like, most of the worst shit that I worried about never even happened. I suffered so much in my life about stuff that never happened, but I was worried it was going to happen. Spent a lot of time suffering, believing my mind, obeying my mind, basically saying you should be stressed. You should be afraid. So we'll get into it in the meditation and in the talk, but discussion about your identification with your mind, your body. So on some level, the question is, who are you? You know, you just ask yourself that question, who am I? And what does your mind say first? Body? Your first name? I am Noah. That's who I am. And then what the Buddha's directing us to, what this practice is, unpacking that. Where is the Noah in here? What part of this impermanent process of a physical form is a reliable thing to identify with? What part of this mind that has a mind of its own is a reliable thing to identify with? So I don't know if that might be too broad, but find two or three people, talk to each other, introduce yourselves, just for like a minute first, just be like, yep, super identified with my body. So I think I'm gonna flip the script a little bit tonight and have the most of the discussion first and then the meditation. Although usually we do this intro, we meditate, and then we have the talk and discussion afterwards. But I feel like this topic in particular, even doing it in one talk, I could kind of, we could break this out into several talks, several weeks, but we'll see how far we get. So this is the fourth foundation of mindfulness. I think that this is the third aspect of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is translated as mindfulness of the Dhamma, Dhamma is the same as Dharma. Dhamma is what is true. The way that they're translating it here, I'm using this chanting book from the Thai Forest Tradition Monastery in northern Thailand. That's the lineage that I most closely associate with. And they're translating it as phenomena, the fourth foundation, mindfulness of the phenomena of being, that which we experience when we turn towards our direct experience. The five aggregates. One dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena in terms of the five aggregates subject to clinging. And that's, it's an important, these five aspects of our being that are subject to us getting attached to clinging, that, you know, subjects sort of lead themselves, like having a body and being attached, clinging to our bodies isn't your fault. It's just natural. It's just, you know, you have a body, you're going to probably take it all real fucking personal. You have a mind, you're going to probably take it all real fucking personal, subject to clinging. And how does one dwell contemplating phenomena in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging? Here one understands, such as form, such as its origins, such as its passing away. So form, here's a body. You, in mindfulness, oh, this is a body. This is this body arising, the impermanent nature of our physical form, and the impermanent, the changing, passing away. It's hard to see day to day or even moment to moment how our bodies are changing. We can reflect back on our lives and see, oh God, my body's changed a lot over these decades of existence, and it continues to change. I keep aging and maybe sickness. But moment to moment, there's an impermanent process unfolding that usually we're not so aware of. Bringing mindfulness to the way they put it, this is form. Its origin, it's passing away, arising and passing. The second one, feeling tone. I talk a lot, I give the instruction a lot, the second foundation of mindfulness, turning toward not just what's happening, but how does it feel? And next week we'll go into the six sense doors, but at all of our six sense doors, everything that we see, hear, smell, taste, physically feel, and emotionally think, and everything is perceived as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Bringing mindfulness to the feeling tone is the second aspect, that whatever's happening, you're either liking it, disliking it, or ignoring it. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. This is how it's arising. This is how it's passing away. Bringing mindfulness to the thoughts, volitional formations is their translation. And again, third foundation of mindfulness. We spent a week looking at this. We practice this a lot. It's a core part of our meditation. Bringing awareness to your thoughts and knowing these are thoughts. And thoughts have a beginning and a middle and an end. And sometimes you get that little bit of distance, and we're trying to get that little bit of distance, rather than the image that I use is thoughts like a bubble, and observing the thought bubbles, rather than being in them and floating off identified with what your mind is thinking, knowing these are thoughts, these are plans, these are memories, these are hopes, these are fears, these are fantasies, these are cravings, and being aware rather than I am planning, I am remembering, I am, it's that little shift to the mind is planning. Isn't that interesting? The mind is remembering, having mindfulness of the mind. Mindfulness of perception, which includes memory, how we perceive things, the conditions that we see the world through, the lens that we see the world through, our perception. Mind states, volitional formations, intentional thoughts, and consciousness. It's a little bit hard to see consciousness. You ever feel like when you're meditating, you can be like, that is consciousness. And the way the instruction here with all of the instruction is seeing the arising of consciousness and the passing away of consciousness, the impermanent nature of consciousness. I tend to misperceive consciousness as permanent, like it's always happening. Sometimes I'm tuned into it, sometimes I'm not tuned into it. But this instruction is pay close enough attention that you see that consciousness is also a process that has arising and passing. In this way, one dwells contemplating phenomena and in phenomena, both internally and externally, or both internally and externally. And then that great last piece that is part of all of it, where he says, or else mindfulness that there are phenomena is simply established in one to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. And one dwells independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And this is how one dwells contemplating phenomena and phenomena in terms of the five aggregates. Does that give you a little bit of a sense of what he's encouraging here? He's saying, you know, we have this body and mind and feeling tones and perception and consciousness, but use your mindfulness to investigate that there are five separate aspects of our being unfolding, and you can bring awareness to it rather than being so identified with it. Unpack it. Oh, this is the body, this is the mind, this is feeling tone, this is perception, this is consciousness. Andy, stop unmuting.
Sorry.
So I wanted to continue this explanation. Before I do, anybody lost? Please, Frank.
So I'm all the way there until number five.
Yeah.
Consciousness, the way I'm used to thinking about it, is when you lose consciousness, you're asleep. Or, you know what I mean? So what is it when you are aware of consciousness passing away, where are you? Right.
I don't feel like I have a great answer. I think what I'm about to say is that consciousness knows itself rather than I am the consciousness. I am that which is conscious. It's something that is a byproduct of being, and it knows itself. But there is that, I don't know, maybe philosophical of like, okay, well, when we're unconscious, when we're asleep, what about dreams? Like there's something that's continuing, some awareness, some consciousness, like what's dreaming? What is the conscious? Because like we all dream, right? But you're unconscious. Something's continuing. Even when we're unconscious, there's something that continues to produce images and stories and perceptions and even feeling tone. Feel pain in your dreams, feel pleasure in your dreams, like something that's continuing to produce it. You were with me. I don't know if you were sitting there with the monk when I asked him the question about consciousness. And he asked me, he said, is the body, is consciousness aware of the body? Or no, what did he say? He said, is the body in consciousness or is consciousness in the body? And I said, I tend to perceive it. I think I know the right answer, but to be honest and humble, I tend to perceive that consciousness is in my body, that my mind is producing consciousness and that it is aware of the body, that it's a byproduct of birth and incarnation. That tends to be how I feel. And he said, well, I feel, and you know, that actually the body is in consciousness, that there's some consciousness that's separate from the body, that's knowing the body. And that is the right Buddhist answer. But I don't, even after decades of meditation, I don't tend to perceive that there's a consciousness. I have this kind of materialist view of, you know, like birth gives rise to consciousness. And it's part of the byproduct of the mind, you know, and it's a very materialist kind of view. But they're saying like, nope, there's this spiritual view that says there's this consciousness that's here that knows the body And that's not just a byproduct of birth. They call it chitta, the heart mind. It's interesting to study and practice Buddhism and to have that, I guess it's humility to be like, I don't experience that yet, but it sounds good. I'm not going to take it on blind faith. I'm going to continue to investigate. It sounds good, but it's not how I walk around perceiving myself or the world yet. So in Heart of the Revolution, I did a little bit more in-depth investigation and feel like it's probably clearer here than I could spontaneously speak tonight. So I'm going to read a couple of pages from this. And I liked translating aggregates or skandhas as piles. Also because like pile is a common insult in my circle, or it was like we would call each other like, you're such a pile. You ever call your friends piles? It's short for pile of shit. But it was like, especially when I was writing this, it was a really common, you know, slur amongst my friend group. And we're like, you're such a pile. And so I translated it as piles as I thought it was funny. A more detailed explanation of what's happening here. The path of freedom is a gradual loosening of the misidentification that create our suffering, misidentifications that create our suffering. The Buddha referred to the process as being like fraying of a tightly wound rope. Little by little, the rope begins to fray and come apart. So think of these five strands that, you know how like a rope is a bunch of different separate strands wound together. So there's the strand of the body and the mind and of perception and consciousness and feeling tone. And they are, you know, you bring those all together and that's, I'm this rope. But what if you start to pull that apart? Is it still a rope when you unfray it? When you remove those things, is it still a rope or is it five strands? The Buddha referred to the process as being like the fraying of a tightly wound rope. Little by little, the rope begins to fray and come apart. These misidentifications are traditionally referred to as the skandhas, heaps, or piles in Buddhism. The piles result in five different aspects of life that we tend to cling to as our fixed identity or misidentity. The body itself, the sense impressions or feeling tones of the body, the mind or objects of the thinking mind, which include thoughts and emotions, perceptions, which includes memory and consciousness. As long as we hold the incorrect view that any of these processes of the mind or body comprise who we ultimately are, we are chained to the causes and conditions that give rise to suffering. Taking any of these experiences as who we are at our core is inevitably going to be a cause of suffering. Why? Because the uncontrollable and unreliable nature of these piles of life. When we believe that we are our bodies, we inevitably feel betrayed by the natural process of sickness, old age, and death. When we believe that we are our minds, we suffer the fate of almost constant judgment, comparison, and fear. Freedom comes from the meditative discipline that allows us to see clearly the impermanent, impersonal, and unsatisfactory nature of these five factors of existence. Let's examine these five skandhas one by one. The body. The human body is a process involving the four elements only. Earth, air, water, and heat are present in this human form. These four elements make up all of creation, both internally and externally. As the body is created in the womb, it is the four elements of the mother's body that creates the fetal form. As the body is born into the world, the earth element mixed with water, air, and heat create the sustenance that allows survival and growth. By absorbing the four elements, each body matures and converts these elements into flesh and blood. So as you maybe remember, in the first foundation of mindfulness a few weeks back, one of the meditation instructions is to investigate this physical form as the four elements. Be mindful that all that you can find in here is some earth element, some air element, some water element. There's nothing else other than these four elements that make up this body. All of physical life in a body is a process of ceaseless change. From childhood onward, our bodies are constantly changing, growing, maturing, and then eventually beginning to decay. The physical body arises out of the four elements, and at death returns to the four elements. Throughout our life in the body, we become more and more identified with our physical form. We rarely question the organic process that is unfolding, and we rarely pause to acknowledge the impermanent quality of the body. We remember being children, and we know that our bodies have changed over the years, but it rarely occurs to us that there is not one cell remaining in our body from childhood. The physical matter of the child's body is completely gone. Only a memory remains. Every cell has been replaced by new cells, but the mind creates a delusion that this is the same body. Thus, we become the pile of suffering that is the impermanent body. This body is demanding and fragile and subject to sickness, old age, and death. It gives rise to the craving for more pleasure and less pain. Freedom from misidentification with the body does not come from self-denial and destruction of the physical form. Rather, it comes from a radical shift in our understanding of what it means to be alive. The Buddhist path of mindfulness meditation begins with a deep investigation of the body and its functions. Through meditative wisdom, we come to understand that we are the temporary caretakers of the body, living with all of the phenomena of a nervous system, a digestive tract, an involuntary cardiopulmonary system, and so on. The body is not who we are, it is just what we are currently experiencing. Freedom from being the pile of the body is often the first step in the process of liberation that is called enlightenment or awakening. Of course, as with all other insights, breaking the misidentification with the body can take place only moment to moment. It is unlikely that we hear these words, reflect on these truths exposed here, and then we never again fall into the wrong view of belief that the body is our identity. It is more likely that over years and years of meditative practice, we slowly loosen the identification and gradually awaken to the freedom of knowing that we have a body, recognizing that it is not our permanent or fixed identity. This is often the first aspect of the fraying of the rope of misidentification. Sense impressions. Life in the body is constantly accompanied by pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral sense impressions. Our mind-body process is wired to experience all things as either pleasurable, unpleasant, or neither. As noted earlier, a built-in survival mechanism causes us to prefer the pleasant experiences over the unpleasant ones, and to ignore or find boring the times of neutrality. This is where the pile of sense impressions comes in. We mistakenly bind ourselves to being content only when life is feeling pleasurable. Sound familiar? Only happy when it feels good. We become so identified with the sense impressions of the body that when the body is experiencing unpleasant phenomena, we create suffering on top of the pain. Thus, staying in the cycle of obeying the dictates of the body's preferences for pleasure. The next step in the process of liberation is to break this chain reaction of suffering whenever life is unpleasant and feeling content only when life is pleasurable. The second level of Buddhist meditation then is an in-depth investigation of the sense impressions within the body. Through moment-to-moment mindfulness, we come to see the impermanent, impersonal, and unsatisfactory nature of both pleasure and pain. So these three characteristics that I'll say over and over with the body, impermanent, impersonal, unsatisfactory, with the feeling tones, impermanent, impersonal, unsatisfactory. I'll say the same thing about the mind states, impermanent, impersonal, unsatisfactory. I'll say the same thing about consciousness and perception. The three characteristics of existence that apply to everything that is the lens we're trying to see through, right? We don't walk around seeing through the lens of wisdom that says this is whatever's happening is arising and passing. But this is the wisdom. This is the Buddha's teaching. This is the insight that we're looking for, the truth of impermanence. And the more we see that and the more we unfray this rope, we start to see it's not so personal. I've been so personally identified with my personality, my body, the feelings that I have, the emotions that come through. We start to unfray that and we say, like, these are impermanent. They're not so personal. It's just part of being human. The only personal part of it is that you took birth. You've incarnated. This is what it's like to have a body, to be temporarily in a body. A couple more. Thoughts and emotions, the third pile. The mind's objects, our thoughts and emotions, are the next experience that we mistakenly identify with. And this misidentification contributes to confusion and unhappiness. Part of our human experience is the ability to think and to experience emotion. The objects of the thinking mind are an integral part of life. After all, we need to be able to plan and to remember, to create and analyze. The mind is not a problem in and of itself. Actually, it's a necessity and can be an ally in overcoming the causes of suffering. But the mind also has a mind of its own, as it were, and it tends to run on old and often outdated software. There are two kinds of thoughts, intentional and unintentional. In other words, those of our deliberate creation and those that are mind-created or non-volitional. When I say the mind has a mind of its own, I'm referring to the non-volitional thoughts that arise without our intention or permission. How often are you meditating and you've politely asked your mind to shut the fuck up? And it just keeps thinking. Non-volitional. I'm not trying to plan. I'm not trying to remember. But the mind just keeps planning and remembering and fantasizing and craving and judging and comparing. And all of that is non-volitional. You're not trying. It's not. You didn't say, I'm going to sit here and judge the shit out of myself, compare myself to everyone else. It's just all by itself. Happens. We become identified with our thoughts, believing every thought that arises in our mind. We become attached to our thinking process and feeling that the mind objects are who we are. For instance, when we're driving down the road and someone cuts us off in traffic, the core experience is fear. Our survival instinct kicks in, creating an unintentional reaction, but the fear is usually covered by the experience of anger, which the mind creates, likewise unintentionally. We tend to take the mind so personally that then we spend time being angry. I'm pissed off at that bad driver. The truth is, fear arose, then anger arose, and both will pass if we let them. Have you had that experience yet where you just watch the arising and passing and you actually see what's underneath? It happens all by itself. It's not, I'm not choosing to get pissed off, annoyed, just the survival instinct. From a Buddhist perspective, the mind is just another organic process of the body. Yes, we think, and yes, the mind offers views and opinions based on past experiences, but the whole process is more impersonal and universal than we know. The mind becomes a hindrance when we mistake the contents of the thinking mind for our true identity. Much of what arises in the mind is just programmed by our survival instinct. How can I get more pleasure? How can I avoid pain? This is the crux of what the mind is usually doing. As you watch your mind, you can just kind of categorize, just watch it, kind of worrying, how can I avoid pain, craving, how can I get pleasure? That's going to be stressful. That's going to be burdensome. It's all just this very impersonal. How can I avoid pain? How can I create pleasure? Almost all of it. We break the chains of suffering by breaking our addiction to the mind. As with any other addiction, the difference between an addict of the mind and a non-addict is that non-addicts can take thoughts or leave them, depending on what is appropriate at the time. Most of us have very little ability to not take on the mind's views and opinions. We walk around strung out on our own thought process, believing whatever arises in the mind. We therefore stay identified with the pile of confusion and cravings that fuel most thoughts and feelings. Perhaps it should not be, I think, for therefore I am, but rather, I think I am my mind, therefore I suffer. Again, it's only through deep meditative transformation that we can escape the bondage of the mind. We cannot think our way to freedom. We must retrain the mind to see through its own ignorant tendencies. And this is, I think, one of the parts of mindfulness and Buddhism that's so maybe tricky or confusing is we are training the mind with the mind. It's not like there's some other, we are training the mind with the mind to see through its own confusion. It's this turning towards, you're using your mind to turn towards your mind to see where there's confusion and also where there is wisdom in the mind. I think next week or the week after, we'll go to mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening and turning towards when those are present in the mind. Two more pages. Perception. The next step on the path of freeing ourselves from being identified with these piles is a radical transformation in how we relate to perception. Our perceived experience is flawed because we see through the lenses of conditioned craving and aversion. Our mind holds onto resentments in a vain attempt to protect us from future harm. We begin to perceive as solid, separate existence where there is none. The self that I mentioned earlier, which we create based on memory. The pile of perception also leads us to deny impermanence. We perceive things as permanent, and thus we assume them to be permanent. There can be no freedom from suffering as long as we continue to perceive ourselves as separate, autonomous beings, and our conditions as permanent. The perception of self as a separate from others begins to break down when we see through meditative reflection the universal and interdependent nature of all things. I hope you've had some of that insight as you start to, it's one of the functions of Sangha, as we talk about it and we sit together and we start to see, I'm not alone. This is not just happening. This is the human condition. This is what we're all going through. The judging mind, the comparing mind, the craving for pleasure, the aversion to pain, the self-centeredness. It's just the human condition. And then we start to take it, so it helps us to universalize it and see it's not me, it's not I, it's not mine. It's the experience of being embodied. It's the experience of having incarnated. The mind is confused. It naturally creates a sense of separation and individuality, but this is a misperception. Although we may feel separate, it is only because of a lack of true wisdom and understanding is blocking the truth of universal connectedness. The more we understand impermanence, the more we understand that on a subtle, perhaps even atomic level, we're just an unfolding pile of energy. You know, they have those microscopes that are powerful enough to see atoms and neutrons. And if we had one that was big enough, like right now we see, you know, we all think we're all these separate bodies. But that scientific perspective, that if we had a strong enough focused microscope, you wouldn't see 40 bodies here. You would see a mass of swirling atomic energy. And that our atoms and neutrons and photons or whatever they're called would be interconnected. You wouldn't see that's all you and that's all you. There would be this kind of swirling mass of atomic energy in the room, interconnected. I believe that that's part of what the Buddha's pointing to. Separateness, yes, on a relative level. And don't take these ultimate truths and not have good boundaries. Like, still keep your autonomy and good boundaries and, you know, don't touch anybody non-consensually and be like, you're my body too. Don't get weird about it. But also ultimately open to this possibility. Last piece, consciousness. And this is what you were asking about, Frank. Consciousness, which receives all of the phenomena of the mind and body that we have thus far been investigating, may prove to be the most challenging misidentification to break. Many wise beings have settled for an explanation of existence that rests on the misperception that we are the consciousness in which all of the world is arising. From a Buddhist perspective, consciousness is just another impersonal, impermanent, and unsatisfactory aspect of existence. Consciousness is not self. It is not our true nature. Rather, it is just another phenomena of mind. Consciousness receives the mind and the body's sense impressions, receives our emotions and perceptions. But ultimately, there is no owner of the consciousness. On the contrary, consciousness experiences itself. We are thoughts without a thinker, sensations without a sensor, perceptions without a perceiver. The mind and body are experiencing themselves. Stop taking it all so personally. Stop falling into the pile of consciousness as self. This is the final task of liberation. As my friend Eric likes to say, don't be such a pile. Does it make sense on some levels what we're being asked to do here in mindfulness? To be aware as much as we can. And you might not, if you're new to meditation, might not be there yet. And even if you've been practicing for a long time, and like I'm happy to admit, like this fifth skanda pile of consciousness, I haven't had that much success breaking my identification with it. And, but I have some confidence that the Buddha's wisdom of saying like this consciousness is not as personal as we're taking it. So many spiritual traditions stop at the I am the consciousness. You know, kind of a lot of the Hindu teachings have this, you know, it's one of the way where Buddhism departed from some of the other Indian traditions, where, you know, they would kind of be identified with this, the consciousness is the true self, is the big self, is the ultimate self. And the Buddha said, it doesn't seem to be in his awakened state. He said, it's not so personal. There isn't a self that owns the consciousness. There isn't a soul. There isn't a something that is conscious. It's just a byproduct of being. Any questions, comments, clarifications about these five aggregates, piles, skandhas, please?
Is the consciousness what people refer to as like the witness? I think that's kind of watching everything.
I think so. I think that's usually what people mean by the witness. That which is mindful, that which knows. Feels like there's a appropriate developmental process that happens in meditation. I think it's quite appropriate part of our development to become identified with the witness consciousness. It's very useful, actually, to see, oh, there's part of me that is aware, that knows that these are just thoughts, that knows about this body being impermanent and not self. There's part of, and it's, I feel like it's appropriate to be identified with it at some point, but the Buddha's saying, don't stop there. Keep investigating, keep looking, and that eventually you will see that even that witness is an impermanent process arising due to the causes and conditions of birth and life. Part of this perspective of consciousness not being self is the perspective of the Buddha's enlightenment and the definition of nirvana. Because the third noble truth says that it's possible to completely be free from suffering, and that you can live this life in this lifetime free from suffering. And if you don't free yourself from suffering in this lifetime, you'll reincarnate. But if you do reach nirvana in this lifetime, you will not come back to this realm, samsara. You will experience nirvana. Now, often we want to think of nirvana as like a heaven realm, that like, I'm going to nirvana. I pack my bags. I'm going to fucking heaven realm nirvana. But when the Buddha was asked about what nirvana is, he said it's a realm where there's neither consciousness nor a lack of consciousness. There's neither form nor a lack of form. There's neither perception nor a lack of perception. And he just negated that tendency that we have to want to identify with, my consciousness is getting liberated. And he kind of, it feels a little bit more like he's saying liberation is a complete unpacking of that consciousness. And what you're doing is you're freeing yourself from the cycle of rebirth. You don't have to come back to samsara. You've entered the deathless. Unenlightened beings subject to death over and over and over. Enlightened being, free from the cycle of rebirth, free from death, entering the deathless. Maybe, I don't fuck. How do I know? Okay, let's meditate since I've been talking for a long time. Just settling into wherever you are, and if you have unpleasant sensations, remember that's part of the practice. Mindfulness, this instruction, first one, mindfulness of the phenomena of form, the phenomena of the body. How do you know that you have a body? What sensations are present that notify this is a body? Contact with the chair, the cushion. Physical sensations, maybe after sitting here for an hour already, maybe some unpleasant sensations in your ass, back, shoulders. Mindfulness of the phenomena of a physical form. The sensations that the breath creates. Perhaps feeling the heart beating. The temperature of the skin. And being aware of this body as the four elements. And aware that this body has an origin, birth, process of existing, subject to sickness, aging. And this body subject to decay and death and impermanence. And in this body, with its six sense doors, open to the investigation of the feeling tones, phenomena of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The arising, passing of painful sensations, emotions. Unpleasant thoughts, sounds, smells. The impermanent nature of pleasure and pain. And the mind, also part of this body, but has its own category, awareness of thoughts and emotions, the phenomena of thinking, of remembering, rising and passing of thoughts. So often we're clinging to our thoughts. As I, as me, as mine. Just as the lungs breathe all by themselves, the heart beats all by itself. The digestive system digests, eliminates, the nervous system feels. The mind thinks. to be open to perception. Volitionally ask yourself the inquiry, who am I? Maybe over and over, see how you perceive yourself what's our perception of who I am? Who am I? Let your mind answer the question, your perception. How do you perceive yourself? How do you consult memory to form your view, your identification with your personality? How others treat you, perceive you as your gender, your orientation, your ethnicity, race. Then investigating, bringing mindfulness to what is it that's aware, what is conscious, what is receiving, what is the witness, what is knowing these thoughts, these sensations, these emotions, these perceptions, these memories. Part of this fourth foundation of mindfulness, mindful inquiry, investigation, how tightly wound we are, this rope we've woven of identification with the body, the mind, the feeling tones, the perceptions, the consciousness. We meditate contemplating the impermanent nature of these five aspects of phenomena, both internally and externally. Remember the refrain, the instruction where the Buddha says, or else mindfulness, that there are phenomena, is established in one to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness. And then one dwells independent, not clinging to anything in this world. Does your identification shift when you eyes open your eyes, that kind of self-consciousness can be easier within the kind of closed eyes internal investigation to let go of the I, me, mine, and just feel the sensations and the emotions and the thoughts and the perceptions. And then we open our eyes and like, oh, nope, gotta play the role again. Gotta put back on the persona. Gotta be identified with my personality and my ego and my whatever role it is again, because there's people to. Questions, some time for discussion before we end. Comments, questions, comments about your experience in the meditation, or any questions or clarifications about this teaching or any other aspect of Buddhist meditation or teachings? Please.
I've been struggling with anxiety a lot. And during the meditation, I thought that there is no I at all. That scared me.
Made you more anxious?
No, it lessened my anxiety, but there was something more profoundly terrifying about it.
It's quite threatening to the ego. When we propose, when we either tell it or we think this question of, we propose the possibility that there is no I, because it's that it's a function of the mind that we call the ego to kind of create the I am an individual. And it's so much of what Buddhism is encouraging us to question. But I think it's very interesting that rather than scary, but also alleviated some of the anxiety. And even you could even sometimes in meditation say, who's anxious? Where is this self that is so fucking anxious all the time? Where is it? I feel the sensations and the shortness of breath and the, you know, I feel all of the symptoms of anxiety and the racing thoughts. But where's the, and I'm conscious of it. I know all the symptoms of anxiety, but who's anxious? What is anxious? Or even that fifth part of what's aware of the anxiousness? Because sometimes it's a lack of investigation and unpacking it that lets us just be like, it's me. It's who I'm a fucking anxious person. And yes, your body is experiencing those. I want to dismiss it, right? Like it is our experience when we're in any kind of difficult emotion or mind state. It's happening. I don't want to say it's not. It is happening. But that question of what is it? Who is it? Where is it? Where does it begin? Where does it, you know, the reflection on impermanence, the arising, the sustaining, the passing. It's interesting sometimes in intense emotions, anxiety or depression, or not that they're just emotions, mind states, and sometimes very persistent. Like what's not anxious in my body? That technique of like, okay, my mind is quite anxious, but how are my hands? How are my feet? How are my, you know, where does the, I can feel it in the trunk of my body, but where does it end? Okay, like somewhere around my thighs, the anxiousness dissipates. Or sometimes you're like, nope, it's in my fingers and toes. Like it's fucking everywhere. It's full body anxiety. But just investigating all of it. And the ego, sometimes we refer to it as Mara. Were you here last week? Yeah. I went off a little bit last week about Mara. Mara is this part of the Buddha's enlightenment story and teaching story. It's what he referred to as that part of his mind that wanted him to stay identified with the causes of suffering. That part that was like, oh, this is scary. That part of your mind that says, yeah, you should be freaked out and stop asking that question. You ever see The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah.
As everybody, I mean, it's sort of an archetypal story, but there's that, I could do this whole talk of the five piles as the different challenges that Dorothy and Toto go through. Of, you know, the you know, kind of scarecrow and the cowardly lion and they're on this journey to Oz, right? The wonderful Wizard of Oz, like, and that as the ego. And remember when they finally get there and they pull the curtain back and he goes like, do not look behind the curtain, the wizard. You do not want to look behind the curtain. And finally, they pull the curtain back, and it's just this little fucking scared dude pushing buttons. And eventually, if you continue to turn towards and ask that question, who's anxious and who am I? And what if there really isn't a permanent solid self that I've been so constructed around? What if it's not as personal as I've been taking it all, ultimately? It's a tricky teaching because on the relative level, like have good boundaries and have a good sense of self-esteem and learn to love yourself and forgive yourself. And all of that shit is true also, right? Fucking love the shit out of yourself and forgive yourself. And then also start to see it's not as personal as we've been taking it to be. And when you look, anybody find yourself when I asked you to, who am I? Where, you know, what is conscious? Any answers were the wrong answers. Whatever our mind is telling us as well, I am. We're not looking deeply enough. There's, you know, there's just, you can't find it. Science hasn't found it. Neuroscience, we've been chopping up people's brains for centuries trying to find out like where's the center of consciousness, where is the self in the brain. Can't fucking find it because it doesn't exist. But when you bring together a body and you bring together a mind, and you bring together feeling tones, and you bring together perception, and you bring together consciousness, it creates a rope that we call me. I, me, mine. We bring these five things together and it creates the self. But you unpack these things, no self, no permanent, solid, separate self. It's just these conditions coming together. One of the other images that has worked for me when thinking about this, because it's not that there's no, it's not that the self is a complete imagination or illusion. It does exist. It's just not, it only exists with these causes and conditions that come together to create it. And I think of, I don't know that this perfectly works, but it works for me. I think of a rainbow. Like rainbows fucking are real. They're not an optical, I mean, I guess they are an optical illusion, but like we all see them, we all, like it's a thing, but we all know that they're the only, the you know, they arise when the conditions are right. When there's enough moisture and enough light and enough heat or whatever, maybe it's just moisture and light. And then it creates this thing and you see it and you're like, oh yeah, it's a rainbow, but I know that it's not that solid or substantial, that it's arising out of the conditions that gave birth to the rainbow and it's beautiful. What if you could think of yourself that way? I know that I'm not that solid and separate and continuous. These conditions have come together. The four elements are here and everything's impermanent and I have a mind and an ego self consciousness. And oh, what a fucking beautiful trip it is to be a person. I'm like a fucking weird rainbow body thing. Rather than solid, separate, I, me, mine. I know I'm getting fucking way out there. you're all rainbows, man. Fucking, it's your fault. It's that Grateful Dead shit, man. Please.
So here's how weird I am. I kind of went on this just now, unwarranted witness, and kind of very tied to the idea that this witness has an opinion, is judging everything that I do and think, and testify against me if asked to, and that I wanted to separate a different word, and that I've always kind of looked for when I'm meditating is this watcher that is truly objective, you know, and that it's not that other judging opinionated thing, but that they're separate, two kind of separate consciousnesses, and they're wrestling with each other all the time.
No, I mean, I like it, and I think that keep going. For all of us, keep inquiring. Don't land in I am any of the judger or the criticizer or the. Sometimes when I'm asking my mind, what is aware, or who is aware, or what is, my mind will say back to me, who's asking? Yeah. Or what's it to you? You know, and just like there is this sort of inner voice that's like, fucking. You know, it's going to answer it. Like the mind will answer itself. Just keep like, well, who's saying what's it to you? Who's aware of the, you know, who's asking? Just keep going. Make it bigger. Don't land in I'm that voice or I'm that voice or I'm that. Keep going. Where are those thoughts floating in? Make it a bigger space, a bigger investigation. Jason, you have a comment, please. We'll end with Jason.
Yeah, just one of the quote from the teachings that I really appreciate in this topic is whatever one conceives of as I am is ever other than that. Whatever one may conceive of as self or I or am is ever other than that. Just that kind. That's what you're kind of saying. This like kind of and keep going and see. What else, you know?
There is no right answer.
Right. Ever other than that. I just found that striking when I heard it years ago.
The only place that I've ever been able to feel okay about landing is that we are a process. We're this unfolding process of consciousness and perception and a body and feeling tones. That's what we are. We're this unfolding process. We're not solid. We're not separate. We're not continuous. We're a process. That's it. And maybe it's ever other than that too. Maybe, but closer to kind of, we are this impermanence unfolding. If there's anything to identify with, I'll end there. Jason, I'll start with announcements. Jason, who was making that last comment, old friend, colleague, good friend of mine, also teaches a class here on Wednesday nights. So if you want another night of the week to meditate, he's here on Wednesdays at 7:30. So come by Wednesdays if you want to sit. I have a day long, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. of practice on April 6th. If you want to join me, register on the website. Or just show up better if you register. I think it's 65. We charge $65 for that, Sebastian.
Yep.
If you can afford $65, it all goes to the center to help pay the rent around here. Pay it. If you can't afford it, you're welcome to come anyways. Everybody is welcome, free of, anybody that doesn't have the ability to pay is welcome to come anyways. So let me know. We'll scholarship you. There is several retreat opportunities. There's still a few spots for the May weekend retreat here in Los Angeles, 2-day silent meditation, 2 nights, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, silent meditation, Vipassana mindfulness retreat in May. In April, I have a refuge recovery retreat in Texas. If you know any homies in Texas, it's sort of somewhere out by Houston, somewhere between Houston and Austin in Texas. If any of you are online for around Texas, there's a 3-day refuge recovery retreat in Texas and Austin in April. The India pilgrimage that I've been talking about for the last couple months is happening. It's open for, we finished posting it. It's open for registration now. There's only 24 spots available. There's only 8 single available, 8 doubles. And so what this trip is going to be, I'm actually doing it through Refuge Recovery. Everyone's welcome. The only, even if you're not in refuge, you're still welcome to come on this India trip with us, but you do have to be sober the whole trip. The 5 precepts of Buddhism apply. And we're going to spend 11 days together in India, 5 days at Bodh Gaya, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. And then after 5 days together there, we're going to get on this Buddhist tourist pilgrimage train. And the train's going to take us to Saranath, the place where the Buddha first gave teachings. It's going to take us to Lumbini, the place where the Buddha was born. There'll be some overnight, and it's a private Buddhist pilgrimage train. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have sleeping cars and a dining car. And it's going to be this really cool India adventure for 11 days and only 24 spots available. So if you're planning to come to that, register early. I'll close registration like in June or July, but register now so we know who's coming. I know it's only March, but that's November 13th through 24th. And before that, in October, I'll do a 9-day silent meditation retreat again here in Los Angeles through Against the Stream for anybody who wants to have a little bit longer silent sitting and walking in depth. You know, these investigations work better actually when you have days and days and days to sit and contemplate and investigate. So join me in some of those practice opportunities coming up. Class is done by donation, everything, even though like we charge some registration fees for the retreats, all of that just goes to cover the expenses. I don't get paid for teaching. I think this year might be, I'm getting close to the 20-year anniversary of this Monday night class within the next few months or early next year, maybe. Every Monday night for almost 20 years now showing up. And I do it because I love the Dharma and because I want to be of service and because I want to help you facilitate, you know, learning each other, you know, meeting each other and learning and practicing and developing as much liberation as you can in this life. And your offering is to support the nonprofit, to help pay the rent. And hopefully if there's something left, I get some support as a teacher. We call it Dana, the practice of making offerings of generosity. So even though it's a free class, please don't think of it as free. Think of it as donation-based. Think of it as you give what you feel appropriate giving. I think, you know, suggested, I never used to do suggested donations. But so many people have asked me like, well, what's the ballpark? Well, like how much do you pay for a yoga class? $25 these days in LA, or more, $30. How much do you, you know, like even going to the movies, fucking $20 to go to the movies. Like think about how we spend our money and then think about how much you appreciate having a place to come and meditate and, you know, find your way with it in that realm. And some people become monthly supporters. And if you can, if you like what I'm doing here and want to become a monthly supporter where you just say, I'm going to give $50 a month or $100 a month, whether I come or not, getting out of that fee for service of I'm only donating because I'm getting something out of it. We're here because of all the people that gave in the past that allow us to be here. And what you give now will allow the people in the future, whether you're part of that or not. And so I think it's a better way to get out of the capitalist fee-for-service system, just generosity to support the Dharma, to support the center. Did I forget anything, Sebastian?
No, that's
good. Good enough? Oh, the book I was reading out of tonight, it was my book, Heart of the Revolution. If you want to investigate those teachings a little bit more, we have them here. There's a link to it on Did you put a link up for the book, Jeff? There's a link to Against the Stream, and you can order the book if you want to get it at home. My mom, who's with us on class, will mail it to you. If you want to purchase it, she'll mail it to you. Lastly, gathering and offering any merit that has been developed as we've contemplated, investigated, practiced the Dharma tonight. Extending this in all directions, sharing the goodness of our life's energy with all living beings. May each one of us dismantle this rope, fray at the edges, get as free as possible. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet for the benefit of all living beings. Peace out. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.